This evening we read from the Old Testament book of Deuteronomy, and we are at the 29th chapter of this Old Testament book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 29. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he had made with them in Horeb. Now Moses called all Israel and said to them, "You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, the great trials which your eyes have seen, the signs and those great wonders. Yet the Lord has not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and ears to hear to this very day. And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you, and your sandals have not worn out on your feet. You have not eaten bread, nor have you drunk wine or similar drink, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. And when you come to this place, Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, came out against us to battle, and we conquered them. We took their land and gave it as an inheritance to the Reubenites, to the Gadites, and to half the tribe of Manasseh. Therefore, keep the words of this covenant and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. And all of you stand today before the Lord your God, your leaders and your tribes and your elders and your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones and your wives, also the stranger who is in your camp, from the ones who cut your wood to the one who draws your water, that you may enter into covenant with the Lord your God and into his oath, which the Lord your God makes with you today, that he may establish you today as a people for himself, and that he may be God to you, just as he has spoken to you, and just as he has sworn to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I make this covenant and this oath not with you alone, but with him who stands here with us today before the Lord our God, as well as with him who is not here with us today, for you know that we dwelt in the land of Egypt, and that we came through the nations which you passed by, and you saw their abominations and their idols, which were among them wood and stone, silver and gold, so that there may not be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turns away today from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations, and that there may be not among you a root bearing bitterness or wormwood. And so it may not happen when he hears the words of this curse that he blesses himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, even though I follow the dictates of my heart, as though the drunkard could be included with the sober. The Lord would not spare him. For then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy would burn against that man, and every curse that is written in this book would settle on him, and the Lord would blot out his name from under heaven. And the Lord would separate him from all the tribes of Israel, for adversity, according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in this book of the law, so that the coming generation of your children who rise up after you, and the foreigner who comes from a far land, would say, when they see the plagues of that land and the sickness which the Lord has laid on it, 'The whole land is brimstone, salt, and burning. It is not sown, nor does it bear, nor does any grass grow there, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeblum, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and his wrath.' All nations would say, 'Why has the Lord done so to this land? Why does the heat of this great anger mean?' Then people would say, 'Because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. For they went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods that they did not know, and that he had not given to them. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against this land to bring on it every curse that is written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from their land in anger, in wrath, and in great indignation, and cast them into another land as it is this day. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." As we read this together, you may have thought when we got to the last verse of that chapter Finally, we're to a place I recognize. I remember that the secret things belong to the Lord our God. In fact, sometimes someone just says an answer to a question that can't be answered. Instead of saying, I don't know, or the Bible doesn't say, well, Deuteronomy 29:29 covers that. The secret things belong to God. And it's true overall in an overarching way about a great swath of Bible subjects. What is the thorn in the flesh that Paul had? Well, that's a secret thing God has that he hadn't told us. What did Paul see when he went to the third heaven? Well, he couldn't say, but it's a secret thing belonging to God to us. What does that spiritual body that we'll have one day look like? It's a secret thing belonging to God and not to us. It covers a lot of ground. And while true that God has told us everything we need to know, and this verse suggests that, he hasn't told us everything that he knows. Now, that would be impossible because we couldn't contain all of his knowledge. And even if we could contain it, we couldn't understand it or fathom it at that, because he is on such a plane higher than ours. He is omniscient and we are not. But while the verse is true even out of context on so many different areas of subject matter, it is especially interesting in the context of this chapter. Because when we put the verse back where we found it here, we find that toward the end of this book of Deuteronomy, which the word means a retelling or reiteration of the law, it is a series of summations of or speeches of Moses at the end of his life to the children of Israel concerning many, many things, not the least of which his inspired concerns about them after he would soon leave them in death. Here he makes reference to the earlier covenant, and now to this covenant, which would continue all the way forward through their time of conquest, led by Joshua in the land of Canaan, and even years to come past there. A covenant of blessing and cursing, depending upon their decision to live by God's way or not, worship him or not, serve him or idols. It was up to them. But the covenant would be strong and bound and firm between God and these people as long as they lived according to his will and served him and him alone, which had not been the case with their neighbors around about who worshiped idols. And in many cases, they had in times past followed suit, not to mention the time of the golden calf and others. But in referencing that, he makes mention of God's care for them during these 40 days they've been wandering in the wilderness. I don't know exactly how many people left Egypt by way of freedom, going through the Red Sea as on dry land, and then wandering for these 40 years. Some scholars say they may be upwards of 2 million people or more, which really is not the answer to the other question. Well, how many did they have left at the numbering before they go into Canaan at the end of the 40 years? And regardless of the number, it's not the same people, because you know that except for Joshua and Caleb, not a one of those who left Egypt entered Canaan. And so all of these standing there under the leadership of Joshua going across the Jordan into Canaan, they were peoples that were born during this time of wilderness wandering. Which goes back to the interesting question that I've always been amazed by, and that is, how do you salvage that kind of a group of people for that length of time and that kind of condition so that they don't just survive, but they thrive and are able to have children and then be healthy and thrive? And God does it. We know how he feeds them. He feeds them with manna from on high. On more than one occasion, he feeds them with quail. He gives them water they need to drink. We have at least two occasions given before us, the one with Moses supposed to strike the rock and he does, and the other when he's supposed to speak to it and strikes anyway. We have occasion of seeing in real time where God gives them water to drink. But here reference is made to their sandals on their feet. And notice what he says in verse number 5. It says, I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you, and your sandals have not worn out on your feet. You have not eaten bread, nor have drunk wine or similar drink, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. And what that has reference to, this, they don't have bread like the bread that you get from sowing wheat or milo or corn or soy. They didn't have wine by growing their own grapes. They had the manna from on high. God provided it. They had the water he gave them from him. And all of this was to show them they weren't sustaining this nation. They weren't sustaining their lives by their own bootstraps, by their own ingenuity, by their own stick-to-itiveness, by their own survivor-like instincts. They were surviving clearly because God was providing for them, and God alone could do it. And surely they had seen it all this time. All the times when they were spent so many days complaining and whining and murmuring and rebelling against Moses and God who sent Moses. All this time they were being kept alive, obviously, clearly, patently, by what God was doing clearly before them. And that's why God says he's done it this way, so that they might know it is from God. And so when I say that question I have is amazing as to how these people in such numbers were kept alive to thrive and to repopulate themselves. It's a question amazing from a human standpoint. From God's standpoint, it's not amazing at all. It's just the way God operates. There's nothing impossible for God. Nothing outside the realm of his ability to do in terms of helping or aiding mankind. The very God who spoke the words, the universe came into existence. What can he not do? The God who said, let there be light, and there was light. What can he not do? The God that has raised the dead. What could he not do? And so he sets this up before he mentions the problems they've had in the past, and those neighbors around them were still having with the worship of idols, which they were not to follow. And you remember well with me, the first two commandments are about that very thing. We shall have no other gods before the God of heaven. Not to make any graven images and worship them. Those first two commandments, the people were obviously violating as Moses came down from the mountain with the first set of the commandments. But that being said, God was very clear that he was the only one to be worshipped. But they had done it. Their neighbors continued to do it. And that would completely violate this covenant he was making with them. And so he makes it very clear. The blessings are obvious. He's taken care of them and will. The curses are most emphasized here because they need to be. It should be obvious what God will do for those who are on his side. He will do everything at his disposal to help them. He's always been that kind of a God. As the psalmist said in the last Psalm 100, the Lord is good, his mercy is everlasting, his truth endures to all generations. As Jesus taught us to pray, give us this day our daily bread. That's the kind of God we serve. But when we choose not to, that's what is emphasized here. The curses that come upon a people and a land and a nation, be they Israel here or the neighboring nations, that turn against the clear will of the sovereign God. And those retributions will be swift and they will be severe and they'll be obvious. Just as obvious in the curses as God's blessings are in the giving of them. It will be painfully obvious who has sent these plagues, these difficulties to the peoples. Just as it was with the plagues of Egypt when they came out of Egyptian bondage, so it will be for the people of God if they turn against God. It'll be obvious just as God has helped them, now it's God who's doing everything against them because of their choice. Which then brings us to this last verse that seems, after saying that, still kind of an odd rejoinder to this chapter. Well, the secret things belong to God. And why is it important to put this here? Why does God want to insert this at this place? Why does it matter in this context? And I think it's because when we consider either their history or our lives, it's easy on one hand to say, well, this is the way God does things, and I submit to Him, and I trust Him. At the same time saying, at least in the back of our minds, but if only, I don't know, I'm not sure this is the way I think it ought to be happening. And then questioning sometimes the way God works things out. The secret things belonging to God in this context concern the way God providentially has for them and will in the future work things out for the good of those who keep this covenant. How He does it. Well, these are the secret things until they're seen. The fact that He will do them, that's obvious. He's put it right down here. A covenant is a promise. And God's made a promise. He'll live up to it if we live up to our end of the covenant. He'll live up to His. This agreement, this covenant God has made, He'll live up to. And so it'll be obvious. It won't be secret when you see the effects of His keeping His word. But the how of how it all works together and seamlessly, for example, in one case, the scheme of redemption plays out over time, things which even the angels desire to look into, things described as a mystery once concealed but now revealed. These things, while they're in the working out phase, do we know the end of a thing before the beginning? Well, no, we don't. Does God? Well, yes, He does. Some of the most spiritist conversations I've had over the years with members of the church who believe in the Bible just as strongly as I do concern this idea of God's foreknowledge, which does not in any way coincide with, contradict with, or have anything to do with the actual foreordination of God. Just His foreknowledge. And where one would suggest the one means the other, I would quibble about that, but that's beyond the scope of this lesson. Just the foreknowledge of God is what we're considering. What does God know ahead of time? Well, in terms of our own decisions, does God know what we're going to do before we do it? In terms of a nation's direction, does God know what they're going to do before they do it? In terms of a world's history, does God know what's going to happen before it happens? And there's the one sense of the idea that God makes the best of whatever happens to make it work into the plan He has going in. That is a good way to look at it. Another way is that God knows everything playing out in that plan before and during and after the culmination of that plan and sees it all from outside of time as if the whole thing is happening when much of it hasn't happened yet from our perspective. And I think that too has a great deal of support for the idea. And I go back and forth myself as to which one is the right one. But regardless which one is the right one, it is the case that so much of what goes on in our lifetimes in real time as we live and plod through day after day and week and month and year after year, not knowing the future, so much that plays out is yet secret to us. but I don't think so to God. Either he knows beforehand what's going to happen, or he orchestrates as things go along to make sure they do happen, in a large macro sense, according to his plan. Individuals may turn and decide to work against the purposes of God, but that in no way has ever thwarted the overall purpose of God for mankind. The Bible is full of examples of individuals and even nations turning against God. Did that in any way thwart God's plan? No. It just worked in the fabric of time and history to bring that plan into further fruition. And again, whether God knew all of that before it happened or kept working as it went to make sure it happened as he willed, matters not. The fact is, as it all turns out, it's beyond our understanding. It's, as we might say, way above our pay grade to understand all of how that works out. You remember we've talked in the past about that promise God makes to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. That from the seed of Abraham, all the families, all the nations of the earth would one day be blessed. And if you draw a line from that promise, that prophecy in Genesis 12, all the way to the death of Jesus on the cross, hundreds of years in the future, it wouldn't be a straight line. It'd be a crooked line of difficulties and obstacles and adversities, situations that would seem to completely upend and undo everything God had planned. But no, in every case, God works it out to where it comes back to where it needs to be and changes just enough to make it come back to where it needs to be, keeps the people, the nation intact, keeps the seed and the seed promise intact, delivers the entire people more than once from captivity nationally. And as most of them leave, a remnant is saved. And finally, in the fullness of time, Christ comes and everything happens just as God intended. Little wonder the angels desire to look into things like that. These are the secret things that belong to God that were not known then. And that's why Paul in Ephesians 3 talks about this mystery once concealed, now being revealed and proclaimed by preachers like himself. And we still to this day, centuries later, can proclaim that same good news message. All of it as answer to these secret things playing out over time. And by the way, you might remember another favorite verse of yours from Romans 8, all things work together for good to those who love the Lord. It's a general principle, but there in the context itself, it deals with this very thing of God's scheme of redemption playing out over time. Now, what does verse 29 mean then? Well, these secret things aren't ours, and so best, to use a colloquialism of our day, best to stay in our own lane and not spend our time in the lane of the secret things. We have a lane, and that's what the covenant's all about. This lane, or responsibility for mankind, for God's people, is not to question God, to bait with God, to lack in faith of God and what he will do. Their responsibility is merely to let God take care of God's business, those secret things. And notice the last part of this verse, those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever. It's God's way of saying you have enough to keep you occupied the rest of your life, the rest of history's lives, with what I have revealed. Don't waste your time wondering about what you don't know, what hasn't happened yet, what may happen next, what could happen down the road, what's around that next corner, what if this happens and then will that make this happen? If that starts to cascade, will dominoes fall and everything collapse? And God says those secret things aren't yours to worry about. They aren't yours at all. Those secret things are mine. I'll work things out. Those things revealed, you got them. It's as if God is saying, stay in your own lane. Read the Bible and live by it and trust me and that'll be enough. And if you don't believe that, in the context, Moses would say, just look down at your feet. When's the last time you got a pair of new shoes? Well, I've been wearing these shoes all my life. Well, how come they're not worn out? Is it because you haven't been walking? No, I've been walking every day of my life, and these shoes haven't worn out once. How's that possible? Well, it's not. That means God took care of you, didn't he? Well, I suppose he did. What have you been eating for 40 years? Well, I've been eating bread that just falls out of the sky. What'd you do? I just gathered it up and ate it. Where'd it come from? I don't know. God sent it. Well, if God took care of you those 40 years, won't he take care of you going forward? Again, it's as if God is saying, stay in your own lane. I'll take care of what you need. You take care of trusting me. The secret things are mine. I've given you what you need. It's a lot like that verse we know from Matthew 6 and 33. After warning his disciples about their worry over what they'd eat or what they'd drink or put on, Jesus then tells all of us, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And all these things, these secret things, these things you worry about, these things you can't figure out, all these things will be added to you. Just seek first the kingdom. Just take care of those things which are revealed. And don't spend all your time anxiously wondering about those things not yet revealed. It's interesting how these principles of centuries and centuries ago that might at first seem so archaic are just as up to date as if they were spoken today. Now, the scriptures, even the old, are given for our learning. If you're here tonight and you're subject to the Lord's invitation, please don't let this opportunity pass, but come now as together we stand and sing.